Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abba Yomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abba Yomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, April 20th, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another action-packed edition of the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast. This program features our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the United States preparation for the withdrawal of their troops from the West African state of Niger. A hangout for African-American youth in Georgia has been targeted by police. We'll have details on that as well. In the West African state of Mali, a heat wave is impacting the population. And in California, three policemen have been charged in the death of a young person. In the second hour, we listen to a report on the rising tension between Iran and the state of Israel. Finally, we will hear a comparative analysis of the histories of South Africa and occupied Palestine. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our music interlude in the West African state of Nigeria. This is from the Cardinal Rex Lawson. Let's listen in. Thank you.
want to speak England, but I am not good scholarship. Come for somebody,
Thank you. Thank you. Korisha,
you boy, him. He ain't be brilliant. He had to be good job for me, Papa. Manisha, to give me a good over Avia. He had a good one. To give me a good as I go good love. In Amu, Momiji, or Remy Makamia, Pamra. In Asme. In Amu.
I don't know.
this now. Say come on, my baby, say you my world. Hey, 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 oh, night come on now.
Don't you
Sound of the legendary Cardinal Rex Lawson. That is music from the West African state of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. Classic Nigerian, West African, Pan-African music there by Cardinal Rex Lawson. You are listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April 20th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to go into our Pan-African Newswire segment right now. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. The United States will begin plans to withdraw troops from Niger. U.S. officials said that earlier today, and what experts say is a blow to Washington and its allies in the region in terms of staging security operations in the Sahel. The planned departure comes as U.S. officials said they were trying to find a new military agreement. The Prime Minister of Niger, appointed by the ruling junta, Ali Lamine Zine, and U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Kurt Campbell agreed on Friday that the two nations would begin to plan the withdrawal of American troops, the U.S. State Department told the international media. Earlier today, U.S. officials gave no timeline about their withdrawal. An American delegation to coordinate the details of the withdrawal process will be dispatched soon. Niger plays a central role in the U.S. military operations in Africa's Sahel region, an area on the edge of the Sahara Desert. Washington is concerned about the spread of jihadi violence, where local groups have pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda and the Islamic State groups. Niger is home to a major U.S. air base in the city of Agadez, about 920 kilometers, that's some 550 miles, from the capital, Niamey, using it for manned and unmanned surveillance flights and other operations. The U.S. has also invested hundreds of millions of dollars in training Niger's military since it began operations there some 11 years ago. However, in relations have frayed between Niger and Western countries since changes of government over the last 4 years. Niger's current government, headed by the National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland, has since told French forces to leave and turned instead to the Russian Federation for security assistance. Earlier this month, Russian military trainers arrived to reinforce the country's air defenses and with Russian equipment to train Nigerians on how it is utilized. There was an attempt on behalf of the U.S. to revise the military agreement with Niger that would allow them to stay. U.S. officials told this, according to the Associated Press. But the agreement between Zine and Campbell shows that the effort has failed. The loss of access to air bases up in Niger is a major setback for the U.S. and its allies in the region because of its strategic location for security operations in the Sahel, said Peter Pham, a former U.S. Special Envoy for the Sahel region. In the short term, they will be hard to replace, said Pham, adding that remaining European Union military presence would likely pull out of Niger following the news of a U.S. departure. The rupture of relations between the two nations would impact the development and humanitarian aid funds destined for Niger, a country at the bottom of many indicators of well-being, Pham said. And in other news related to Niger, the United States is attempting to create a new military agreement with Niger that would allow it to remain in the country. Weeks after the CNSP said its presence was no longer justified, two Western officials told the Associated Press on yesterday. The officials who spoke on conditions of anonymity due to the sensitivity of the situation said Washington was actively working on options for a revised deal aimed at retaining its foothold in the West African nation. Niger plays a central role in the U.S. military's operation in Africa's Sahel region. Washington is concerned about these of jihadist violence where local groups have pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic groups. Niger is home to a major U.S. airbase in the city of Agadez, some 920 kilometers, that's 550 miles from the capital of Niamey, using it for manned and unmanned surveillance flights and other operations. The United States has also invested hundreds of millions of dollars in training Niger's military since it began operations there in 2013. In other news, in the United States, thousands of African-American college students expected during this weekend for an annual spring bash at Georgia's largest public beach will be greeted by dozens of extra police officers and barricades closing off neighborhood streets. While the beach will remain open, officials are blocking access to nearby parking. Tybee Island east of Savannah has grappled with the April beach party known as Orange Crush since students at Savannah State University, a historically black school, started it more than 30 years ago. Residents regularly grouse about loud music, trash littering the sand, and a revelers carrying out rowdy behavior in the area. Those complaints boiled over into fear and outrage a year ago when weekend crowds of up to 48,000 people daily overwhelmed the 3-mile, 4.8-kilometer island. That left a small police force scrambling to handle a flood of emergency calls reporting gunfire, drug overdoses, traffic jams, and first and fifth fights. Mayor Brian West, elected last fall by TB Island's 301 residents, said roadblocks and added police are just for limiting crowds. He hopes the crackdown will drive Orange Crush away for good. Are you listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal? In the state of California, three Northern California law enforcement officers have been charged with involuntary manslaughter and the death of a man who was pinned face down during a 2021 incident that drew comparisons to the murder of George Floyd the year before in Minneapolis. The charges against James Fisher, Cameron Lee, and Eric McKinley were announced Thursday by Alameda County District Attorney Pamela Price. The charges were filed just before the statute of limitations were to expire and marked a reversal of a decision by a previous district attorney which cleared the officers of wrongdoing. Now, Mario Gonzalez, who is 26, died in the city of Alameda on April 19th of 2021. McKinley, Fisher, and Lee were all Alameda police officers at the time. McKinley and Lee are still with that department, but Fisher is now a Contra Costa County Sheriff's deputy. The officers confronted Gonzalez after receiving 911 calls that said he appeared disoriented or drunk. According to police video, he resisted being handcuffed, and they pinned him to the ground for several minutes before he became unconscious. The county coroner's autopsy report listed the cause of death as toxic effects methamphetamine with the contributing factors of physiopsychologic stress and alterations and restraint, morbid obesity, and alcoholism. Then District Attorney Nancy O'Malley subsequently found that the officer's actions were reasonable. A second independent autopsy done at the request of the Gonzalez family, lawyers found that he died of restraint asphyxiation. The district attorney's office noted the second autopsy in announcing the involuntary manslaughter charges. And finally, in the West African state of Mali, street vendors in the capital of Bamako are peddling water sachets, ubiquitous for this part of West Africa during the hottest months. This year, an unprecedented heat wave has led to a surge in deaths, experts say, warning of more scorching weather ahead as the effects of climate change roll even further into the continent. The heat wave began in late March, as many in this Muslim-majority country observed. And, of course, the holy Islamic month of Ramadan was dawn to dusk fasting. On Thursday, temperatures in Bamako reached 44 degrees Celsius. That's 111 degrees Fahrenheit. And weather forecast says it is not letting up anytime soon. The city's Gabriel Touré Hospital reported 102 deaths in the first 4 days of the month, compared to 130 deaths in all of the April last year. It's unknown how many of the fatalities were due to the extreme weather, as such data cannot be made public under the regulations imposed by the country's military rulers. Sheikh Traore, Mali's general director for health, said significantly more elderly people have died during this period, although there were no statistics available due to the measures. Mali has experienced two coups since 2020, leading a wave of political instability that has swept across West and Central Africa in recent years. Along with its political troubles, the country is also in the grip of a worsening insurgency by militants linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April 20th, 2024, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Oh, yeah.
Roy Redman doing his rendition of the Beatles song, A Good Day Sunshine, which was on the originally on the Revolver album from 1966. This track was released in 1967, Good Day Sunshine by Roy Redman. And, of course, the situation involving the tense standoff between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the State of Israel is continuing to unfold. We're going to play a interview with Professor Mohammad Mirandi from Tehran University, who is a professor of English literature and Orientalism. And he is going to speak about the current situation in Iran.
Welcome to the Palestine Chronicle. I'm your host, Robert N. Lakesh. In today's show, we'll be bringing you an interview with Professor Mohammad Mirandi, an expert on post-colonial literature and an academic at the University of Tehran. Our interview focused on Iran's retaliatory military operation against Israel, in addition to the Islamic Republic of Iran's role in supporting the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. We got into a number of issues, including the justifications behind armed struggle against an occupying power, and why Israel has been dealt a number of blows over the past 6 months. Thank you for being here with us on Palestine Chronicle. And I want to jump right into things. Obviously, we've seen what's been happening over the past few days and the media's reaction to Iran's retaliatory strikes. How successful, in your mind, were these strikes? We hear from the corporate media that and the Israelis that 99% of all the munitions fired were shot down. It was a massive success. They've now given a name to their defensive operation, they say, which they collaborated with the United Kingdom, France, and the U.S. And others like Jordan to conduct. How successful do you think that Iran's retaliatory actions and strikes were?
It was a complete success. There's no doubt about it. The corporate media can say what it wants. They've been dishonest from the beginning. They've been supporting the Israeli genocide. They're partners in crime in Gaza. So if they were to admit the truth about Iran's retaliation to the Israeli crimes, I would be shocked. I would really be shocked. When you see the British foreign minister or the foreign secretary humiliated on TV by Sky News, which is very sympathetic, that just shows how bad it is. When he said how evil Iran was, and the I think you probably saw it, I think many people have seen it, and the interviewer, she said, well, what if there was a British embassy that was bombed or a consulate, and he said, well, we would respond. So the hypocrisy in everything they say and everything they do is, whether it's the government or the media, it's clear for us all to see. The world has changed, and I think Western corporate media has been pretty much exposed for at least the more questioning sort of people. What happened was that the Israelis carried out a crime. The Iranians did the smart thing. First, they went to the UN. The world condemned it, except for a number of Western countries, as usual. And the UN Security Council did not condemn the Israeli regime, let alone punish it, because the US, France, and Britain refused to condemn it. In other words, they supported the bombing of the Iranian embassy. And so did other countries like Germany. But the Iranians received global support, and that gave Iran an opportunity to strike back at the Israelis, because there was a consensus across the world about what the Israeli regime had done to Iran. Until then, the Iranians had shown patience during the Western dirty war in Syria, where they supported ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups. Iran sent advisors and sometimes troops to Syria. when there were tens of thousands of foreign fighters there. And at that time, the Israelis would target Iranians. But the Iranians didn't retaliate back then because the focus was on defeating the extremists, the Western-backed extremists. And later on, when more recently, when the genocide in Gaza began, again, because of Iran's support for the resistance, the Israelis attacked Iranian advisors and officers, and the Iranians still remained patient. But by striking the embassy, the Iranians were forced to respond because this was a major act of aggression. It was an attack on our sovereignty. And if Iran hadn't responded, the Israelis would have continued to bomb other embassies and other buildings in this in Damascus as well that belonged to the embassy. So Iran had to make sure that this wasn't repeated. And so what Iran did was that it waited for well over 10 days. So it carried out psychological warfare with the Israelis. And then the Iranians notified everyone that they were going to carry out an attack. They warned countries in the region that have American bases that if the U.S. uses your bases, we will punish you. And they backed off. And the Iranians knew that the Jordanians were going to cooperate. They knew that the Americans were going to be involved. And the Americans basically were the ones who had the most prominent role here. But Iran was very smart. They made these announcements. They launched the drones, a large number of very old and cheap, inexpensive drones that had none of the Iranian latest technology. And they, the Americans and the Israelis and the others had ample time to prepare themselves. So when the drones reached Palestine, the Americans started, and the Israelis and the others started to shoot them down, but they didn't understand that these were A, decoys, B, a means to gather intelligence, because the Americans and the Israelis were using all of their capabilities. And so the Iranians learned a lot, whereas they gave nothing. And C, they were using very expensive missiles to down these dirt cheap drones. So ultimately, the drones probably costed a couple of million dollars, maybe. I mean, they're very old. They had to get rid of them somehow. So they're not even worth a couple of million dollars, I guess, to the Iranians. And the Israelis alone spent over $1.3 billion. So the damage done to the Israelis is quite significant. Those missiles are very expensive, but also there are not very many of them out there because a lot are being used in Ukraine as well. So there's a shortage of these missiles. So Iran gathered its intelligence, and also the Iranians fired a series of older missiles, and again, they were meant to have the air defenses attack them, and they were for gathering intelligence, but they were also decoys, and they had no modern Iranian or new technology that could be of value to the United States or the Israelis. So they were also downed. Another expensive act on the Israeli behalf and the Americans. And then the Iranians also fired a handful, I don't know, maybe 10 to 20 missiles that were directed at two military targets, an air base in the south and a military intelligence gathering base in the north. And those missiles struck their targets. So the Israelis, and these were two of the most well-protected places in Israel. The air base in the south is where the F-35s are. It's where they carry out the airstrikes against Gazans. It's where the planes came from when they attacked the Iranian embassy. So the Iranians sent a very clear message to the Israelis that we can hit you very easily. The Iranians forced them to cough up a lot of money, the Iranians gained a lot of intelligence. They depleted the Israeli and American missiles. And so if the Israelis, and then more importantly, the Iranians said, we've changed the equation. From now on, it doesn't matter if the Israelis attack Iranians in Syria who are not in the embassy. Any Iranian that's attacked anywhere in the world, or any Iranian asset that's attacked anywhere in the world, Iran will directly attack Israel. So that has changed everything. It makes things far more difficult for the Israelis than before. It's narrowed down the room for maneuver for the Israeli regime. This, I think, is even more important than the operation itself. So if the Israelis carry out an attack on Iran or an attack on Iranian assets abroad, they will see a massive response, not what we saw a couple of nights ago. What happened a couple of nights ago was an intelligence gathering operation. It was also signaling to the Israelis that we can hit your most important bases. And it also caused, it forced the Israelis and the Americans to spend a lot of their resources. And for Iran, it was literally free. When I say the Iranians spent a few million dollars, I don't know in all how much it would have costed, maybe 10, 15, I don't know. But a lot of these old missiles and drones are not really worth anything because they're not going to be sold anywhere. They're old. So it was almost, for Iran, perhaps almost free carrying out this operation.
Well, it was interesting looking at it. Obviously, I'm no military expert here, but looking at it, the entirety of the incident lasted about 5 hours. And of course, all flights were grounded. There was a lot of pre-warning as well. And yet still missiles managed to hit their targets, which to myself seemed very significant. And you said that this is now a new equation. And we've heard this from Iranian officials as well, that the equation has changed. Just focusing in on a little bit of the context, because obviously there are decades of context that we could go into. At the start of the year, actually late December, the Israelis launched their first attack on Damascus, assassinating an IRGC official. At this time, shortly afterwards, we saw that Iran did hit Mossad targets in Mossad headquarters, they said, in northern Iraq, and also there were missiles fired into Syria's Idlib. At that time, it appeared that Iran was threatening a retaliation and signaling that it was going to retaliate. Then we saw two actions carried out after that by the Israelis, the assassination of, I believe, 5 IRGC members in Damascus. And then after that as well, what I believe the New York Times reported was Israeli involvement in what appeared to be sabotage operations inside of Iran. After that, we didn't see anything until the attack on the consular segment of the Iranian embassy. My question to you is, how much in Iran's strategic thinking here has the conflict in Gaza, the genocide in Gaza, affected the thinking of Iran when it comes to actually responding to the Israelis? What consideration is made of Gaza and what the Palestinian resistance is currently doing in resisting, but also attempting to reach a ceasefire and negotiations? Does that have any link, or are these two issues separate?
Well, Iran's support for the Palestinian cause goes back to the beginning of the revolution. And the military capabilities that you see today in Gaza are because of the heroic efforts of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and their allies and the other groups in Gaza. But of course, it's because of the support that Iran has been giving to them over the decades. All those tunnels and those capabilities that you see today that have bogged the Israeli regime down, They didn't come out of the blue. They're all from Iran. The Iranians helped a lot. They invested a lot to create those capabilities. So for Iran, the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine are extremely important. The reason why Iran has been sanctioned so heavily over the past few decades, and the reason why the U.S. imposed maximum pressure sanctions under Obama and again under Trump, was not because of the nuclear program or because of human rights or terrorism or whatever excuse the Americans or the Europeans would use. It's because of Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. And therefore, there's no country that has sacrificed as much as Iran for the sake of Palestine willingly. Of course, besides Syria and Lebanon and Yemen, and of course the Palestinian people themselves. So, and the dirty war in Syria, I think it's becoming increasingly clear to people that the reason why they carried out that dirty war was to prevent Iran from helping build this network of resistance. They wanted to destroy Syria, fragment Syria, and NATO was behind it all. And sadly, back then, a lot of people were fooled. These dictatorships in the region were using sectarianism and NATO and regional countries were funding the most evil of terrorist groups and calling them freedom fighters. And most people were fooled because whenever you say Iran, immediately there is a consensus among the dictatorships in the region and Western regimes, and they work together to create sectarian hatred, racial hatred, and Iranophobia and Islamophobia. And it's been pretty effective in the past. So that dirty war, and we all, I think you know as well as I, from the very beginning, we had the email that was leaked by WikiLeaks, where Jake Sullivan, the current National Security Advisor, told Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State back then, that Al-Qaeda is on our side in early 2012. So from the very beginning, the U.S. was working with the terrorists. And when Iran was saying this back then, unfortunately, many people were rejecting it. But later, then we had the Defense Intelligence Agency document in 2012. We had the leaked audio of the subsequent Secretary of State of the United States, Kerry, where he said that we allowed ISIS to advance on Damascus. It was clear what was going on in Syria. And the objective back then was to break the link between the resistance and Iran. It's because Syria played a major role in helping Hamas and Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah and so on. So Iran has invested a lot, both by preventing the dirty war in Syria from succeeding, by creating and helping to create the defense systems and defense capabilities in Gaza and Lebanon, and of course in Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. So obviously, Iran is not going to allow the genocide to be forgotten in this exchange. And that is why the Iranians showed strategic patience when their officers were being murdered by the Israeli regime in Syria. But this time round, the Iranians had to react because, as I said, when the Israeli regime bombs an embassy, then they can bomb other embassies. There, no one is safe anymore. And so therefore, the Iranians had to respond. But I think actually the Israeli regime made a major mistake because forget the West, forget the Western mainstream media and Western governments. They are isolated now. The world has seen what they've done in Gaza. They have no credibility. Their image has been wrecked. Their soft power demolished. The fact that they effectively supported the attack on the Iranian embassy, they've been exposed to everyone. But the rest of the world, they supported the Iranian act. So the world is not going to look away from Gaza and because of what the Israelis and the Iranians are doing to each other. But in I think that actually what Iran did strengthened the resistance because the Israelis now have a new cause for concern. They see the Iranian power. Again, forget the Western media. They can pretend. I mean, they've been saying for 2 years that Ukraine has won, Ukraine is winning, and Russia is losing, and now they're suddenly everyone's worried about the fate of Kiev. They've been lying. They've been lying to their public. They've been wasting hundreds of billions of dollars for nothing, and they've lost trillions of dollars because of the sanctions and because of the the fact that they no longer have access to cheap gas and fuel. But suddenly now we're being told that things in Kiev are not good. But so what about all the things that we've been told over the past couple of years? So the Western media has no credibility, and we shouldn't really concern ourselves with that. The fact is that the Israelis know that if they attack Iran, they'll be hit very hard. And it's a big morale boost for the Palestinians. We saw when the drones were coming in, or the missiles were coming in, or when a missile would strike the military bases, because there's footage of that. We saw how the Palestinians were celebrating, and how for the first time in 6 months, Palestinians in Gaza were saying that there were no drones striking us, and for once we slept at night, and which, you know, many in Iran, when they heard that news, like in the news on television, when the people were celebrating and they were told that Palestinians were had slept that night for the first time, Iranians were weeping to hear the news. So it was, for many, an emotional moment. So I think it was a big mistake by the Israelis, and the Israelis have lost in Gaza militarily. They've lost on the border with Lebanon militarily. Their escalation with Iran will lead to further loss. There's no escaping defeat. The further they push, the further they escalate, the greater the defeat will be for this horrible apartheid regime. And another reason why it's very clear, piece of evidence that shows that the Americans are incapable of, or the Israelis are incapable of, blocking Iranian missiles and drones when they want to hit them, is Yemen. The Americans and the British came in and said they're going to deal with Yemen. The Israelis said that no ships are going through. And Yemen does not have the drones and missiles that Iran has. The Americans and the British and the Israelis have failed completely in the Red Sea. And they've only hurt themselves, because every time the Yemen uses the same strategy as Iran does. They send a bunch of cheap drones out there. The Americans and the British and others are forced to fire all sorts of expensive missiles. And the Yemeni armed forces and Ansar laugh at them. And then when a ship comes that they have to strike, they fire a single missile and they hit their target. That's exactly what the Iranians are doing. That's exactly what Hamas and Islamic Jihad also did. If you recall, they would fire lots of rockets at Israel, and the Iron Dome would bring them down, and the Israelis would say this is a great success. But in reality, it's a great failure, because they were sending, like, what, $500 rockets, and the Israelis would knock them down with, like, I don't know, $50,000 missiles. For the Israelis, all of this is simply a failure, but they refuse to acknowledge it, because they have to preserve that image of power. But in reality, the Israeli regime has shown itself to be barbaric to the world. It has shown itself to be weak and vulnerable. It has failed in intelligence gathering, as we saw on October the 7th. It's failed militarily, because it's never been able to capture this small dot on the map called Gaza after 6 months. And it's exposed itself, as I said, as a barbaric and brutal regime that is similar, if not worse, than the Nazis in the Second World War, because of the sheer hypocrisy that they show. They massacre people, and they pretend to be the victims. At least the Nazis, when they massacred people, they weren't telling, and they weren't doing it in front of the eyes of the world. This is something actually that's unprecedented. Saddam Hussein, Hitler, whoever, all the dictators and of old, none of them massacred people in front of a live audience. This is the first time that it's being done, and the Israelis in the West have been supporting it. So they are the victim, but they're carrying out genocide in front of a live audience, and they expect the world to believe what they say.
Well, it's interesting because there's obviously a lot to unpack from what you just said there. But specifically honing in on the strategy of different resistance groups, and of course Iran and Yemen as well as actual countries participating in battles with the Israelis and responses to the Israelis. A lot of people leveled the criticism at Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the PFLP, and the other groups that exist in Gaza, that its rocket fire was only a justification for Israel to hit them back. And because the rockets weren't doing a great amount of damage, they were essentially useless. And they helped build, let's say, a propaganda narrative for the Israelis to claim to be the victim. Similarly, what we've seen here is that with Iran's retaliation, there's been the narrative that because not every single drone got through and we don't see videos of carnage in Tel Aviv and Haifa, then somehow this means that it's an excuse for the Israelis now to claim victim and that this didn't have any sort of impact. And this is the narrative that I've seen that has been spread throughout not only Western media, but also we've seen in Gulf media as well. We've seen this argued the same way, that this is simply a justification now for Israel to play victim after what it did in Gaza, and that we shouldn't pay any attention to what the actual strategy of that retaliatory strike was, similar to how we're not supposed to pay any attention to why Palestinians in Gaza, obviously these are two separate things on different scales of what the weaponry can do as well, why they actually fire those rockets. So what would your response be to that narrative that Iran simply gave Israel the ability to play victim and then carry out whatever aggression it seeks, whether in Gaza, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, wherever else?
Yes, these are the arguments made by those who don't do anything for Palestine. They don't fund the resistance groups. They just sit back and either do business with Israelis or they do nothing at best. Maybe some people are think that if they tweet a few things or retweet a few things that they're, you know, making a big difference. Those who are paying the price are the ones who can really make a legitimate argument or argue these issues. Countries in the Persian Gulf, they have from top to bottom, they have relations with the Israeli regime, every single one of them. And the Americans are very, and the Europeans are very influential across the Persian Gulf. There's not one exception to the rule. Some of them do trade, extensive trade with Israel, like the Emiratis, and they do, they have military and intelligence cooperation with one another. Oh, and the Emiratis are, by the way, putting themselves at risk as a result, but that's for another time. Turkey, despite all the rhetoric, it's been exporting and importing from Israel. It's been doing business as usual for the last few months. So it's obvious that those who are indifferent or have been effectively indifferent to what's going on in Gaza, that they would make any excuse to justify their own actions or inactions. And of course, the West would do the same. They are the ones who are supporting the genocide. They don't care about the people of Gaza. So when Western mainstream media makes this argument, it's highly hypocritical too, because if the Iranians did not strike the Israelis, it wouldn't have made a difference in their policy towards Gaza. So the fact remains that those countries or those groups that are putting pressure on the Israelis are the axis of resistance. No one else is doing anything enormous. Maybe one could say that Al Jazeera Arabic is playing a role, but you have to look at it within a context. Al Jazeera Arabic is allowed to play that role by the Americans because there's a complicated relationship between Qatar and Israel and the role that Qatar wants to play. I'm not saying that it's there aren't sincere people working there. There are a lot of decent people working in Al Jazeera, and especially in Al Jazeera Arabic, you see a strong support, amount of support for the cause. But Qatar has not paid a price for its support for Palestine, and it hasn't been suffering like Iranians have, or the Lebanese, or the Syrians. In fact, many of these countries helped destroy Syria and created the devastation that we see today. And even today, they still pretend that they were supporting the right cause by funding ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Ahrar al-Shamt or Jaish al-Islam and, you know, the different terror groups the Israelis never bomb, the Americans never bomb, the funding, you know, their neighboring NATO countries, whether it's in Idlib or in Al-Tanf, where the Americans are, they're all safe and sound. I think it's understandable why some people would make this argument, but that's nonsense. In 2018 and 2019, during the Great March of Return, the people of Gaza didn't even use rockets. They were just marching. Sometimes they'd throw stones. What happened then? 240, 250 of them were murdered by the Israelis. Many of them were maimed for life because the Israelis would target their kneecaps or their arms, and they would, you know, celebrate, and they would, you know, there's a lot of evidence about what they did during the Great March of Return, and the Western media ignored it all, even though it was outrageous. There was footage where the Israeli soldiers would say, I could hit that guy like a kilometer off, and I could hit him in the knee, and then when they hit him, they'd all jump up and down or celebrate. This is the sort of the brutal, barbaric, illegitimate regime that we're talking about. So when the Gazans fire off rockets, well, if these governments are so upset, then they can go and fund them and give them more weapons and more advanced weapons and more support alongside the Iranians. But what the Gazans have done, whatever it is, it has succeeded because the Israelis have been unable after 6 months to take Gaza. And those rockets that have had no impact or little impact, according to these people, those rockets have forced Israelis to spend a large amount of money to counter them, and it has created fear among Israelis. That's why many of the settlements around Gaza are empty now. So it's caused a lot of financial difficulty for the Israeli regime, and resources have to be put in place to block the rockets. So it's been a part of the broader military strategy of the resistance, and Hamas has shown its capabilities both through the heroic acts of its members during these 6 months, but also through its innovative strategies and the brilliance that its commanders and the commanders of Jihad and the others have shown. No one can deny the achievements of the resistance. If they want, they can say, well, why all these people have been murdered? Yes, of course. But that's what the enemy did. That's not what they did. If they're going to halt resistance because the other side is evil, then the Algerians shouldn't have resisted the French. In the Indian subcontinent, no one should have resisted the British. In South Africa, no one should have or in Southern Africa, no one should have resisted against the white supremacists. So all we have to do is say, well, the other side is brutal, so, you know, submit. That is not acceptable to many people across the world. Many do submit. We see that submission. We see that submission among all those countries that have political relations and business relations with the Israeli regime, or intelligence or military relations with the Israeli regime. They've all submitted in one form or another to the powers that be. But the axis of resistance from Gaza to Yemen to Lebanon and Iraq and Syria and Iran, that's not their That's not within their worldview. They don't believe that.
Well, it's interesting because you brought up the Great March of Return, and I think that's very important to properly analyzing what's going on here and understanding armed resistance as well and why we see the kind of armed resistance we see today, specifically in Gaza. But that can also be transferred over to other fronts as well, that if there is passivity when it comes in the face of overwhelming violence, then the violence will continue and it can be seen as a right for a free-for-all. And so there has to be some sort of retaliation. In Gaza in 2017, Hamas were attempting to do a deal with the Palestinian Authority to bring them in to take over the civil administration. The United States is understood to have been the reason for blocking that. That could have helped lift the siege and ease the lives of Gazans. The following year, we saw that Hamas and all the Palestinian factions endorsed the Great Return March, which was overwhelmingly nonviolent. I mean, if you're going to call it violent, it's throwing stones at soldiers with sniper rifles across a militarized fence. And like you said, mass murder of men, women, children, the elderly, journalists, medical workers, and the world did not care. There was absolutely very minimal coverage. When they did cover it, they talked about Israel's right to defend its border against these unarmed people. And I think after that, and after months and months of the Israelis bombarding Gaza, during which Hamas didn't actually respond, then we saw later in the year that there was an escalation. And from there, we started seeing that the stance of the resistance in Gaza actually became more aggressive because they actually tried those peaceful routes. That is actually something there. And in the case of Iran, as far as I can see it, I've seen that we can look back to the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. We can look back to many acts of sabotage and the assassination of nuclear scientists dating back to perhaps 2010. And we haven't seen a direct strike on the Israelis. We have seen restraint. Obviously, there have been responses, but we've seen restraint. And when you rob the context from the situation, like is often done, then this creates a situation where you can start to point fingers. Well, if you resist, then you're going to get somebody firing back at you and committing such and such heinous crimes. The question off the back of that is talking about the agency of different groups in the region and countries in the region, why they choose to resist, is there's often the question, and perhaps we'll end on this note and discussing this. There's often the question of how much influence Iran has over Islamic Jihad and Hamas and all the different resistance groups in Gaza, as well as throughout the region. We hear in Western corporate media that Iran has proxies and that these proxies act on their behalf, and that Iran is playing a big game in order to, destroy Israel and combat Israel. And it pulls all the strings at every single moment, and none of these groups have any agency. And they even add in a lot of sectarian language. What's your response when people say things like this, for instance, that Iran has complete control over its proxies, as they call them? How would you respond?
No, Iran doesn't have any proxies in the region. These are all Iranian allies. And that's exactly the difference between Iran and these Western regimes or their regional client regimes, in that they do have proxies and they think that Iran is like them. It's the opposite. Iran's relationship with Hamas is one of two allies with Islamic Jihad. It's the same with the other groups, with all of the Palestinian groups that are carrying out resistance. Iran has a brotherly relationship, and Iran supports them. Iran doesn't tell them what to do. They know what to do. They're on the ground. They know better what needs to be done to protect their people, whether it's in Gaza or the West Bank or hopefully in future within the 1967 borders. They know best. But Iran's responsibility is to empower them. The same is true in Lebanon. The same is true in Yemen. And the same is true in Iraq and Syria. All of them, and the reason why they're all working together is that they are all ideologically close to one another. They are anti Zionist, they're anti-racist, they are anti-imperialist, they're opposed to colonization and Western domination, and they are therefore working together, and their relationships have become closer and closer, especially during the past 6 months. So they all have agency. Denying them agency is actually increases miscalculation in the West. Just like the Iranian retaliation against the Israeli regime, if they want to call it a victory for Israel, that's fine. We don't care. We're not out there to win public approval in the West. They can, you know, they can fool their own people or their elites as much as they want. What's important is what happens on the ground here. And they can call these people proxies. That's fine. It only leads to further miscalculation, because proxies are the sort of people that when the money runs out, they disappear. And that's one major reason why they sanctioned Iranians and tried to collapse. But even during difficult times, these resistance movements continue to grow. Why? Because they believed in what they were doing. They believe in what they're doing. Hamas is their cause is a just cause. We have a responsibility to support Hamas. We not only do we not condemn Hamas, we commend Hamas for October the 7th. We commend Hamas and their allies for what they did on October the 7th. Maybe some combatant carried out a crime here, or someone did something wrong there, or some innocent child. That's true. And the same is true about the French resistance. And the same is true when the ANC was struggling for independence, and when the Algerians were fighting against French occupation. All of this can be true, but you, again, as you were saying earlier, you have to look at it within context. You have to look at the broader picture. Hamas, when they took of course, all the rape allegations were untrue, the beheadings were untrue, and the reason I think that the West tried to push this so much later on, it was after the exchange of prisoners that this became a big issue. And it was, I think, because the Israeli prisoners that were released were smiling, and they were, you know, sometimes hugging the resistance fighters, and that was something that shocked the Western public. So they had to start making these claims about or building upon or pushing these outrageous claims that are very Orientalist, by the way, you know, because the Orientalist stereotype about the hypersexualized Arab man, and that sort of thing. It's been, you know, around for centuries, and they play on that sort of thing. What Hamas did was a response to decades of injustice, to decades of murder and ethnic cleansing. Gaza was a concentration camp turned into a death camp. It has been bombed repeatedly over the years. The people have been put under siege for decades. And any dignified human being would not accept that state of affairs. So people can complain about the tactics of Hamas or Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah or Iran, but first they should pick up a stone and throw it, at least throw a single stone somewhere, and then they can start complaining about the tactics or the strategy of the resistance.
Well, I think it's very.
And one final thing that I should add is that during the Great March of Return, it wasn't only stone throwing youth that were being killed. Old women carrying flags were being murdered. Young female medics, way in the back of the crowd, were murdered by snipers. They were true monsters, and just as they are today, The Israel is a racist regime with a racist population, and the West is responsible for this, not because they enable it, but because for decades they've pampered these racists, and therefore they've strengthened these racist narratives, which have led to the atrocities that we see today.
And I think that's very key context when we're looking at this, because, you know, some people, they might hear you say what you said about Hamas and October 7, and because they have the narrative which has been fed to them, which includes all of these atrocity propaganda points, but also that, you know, robbing the military offensive of any military value and just pretending like soldiers weren't targeted and there was no meaning to it, it was just an attack for the sake of instilling terror into Israelis, they forget history, I think, and that is very key. You mentioned, for instance, in the case of Algeria, the Algerian resistance had planted bombs in packed areas for the white settlers. That's true, and they killed white settlers. Also, even if you want to go back to the Haitian Revolution, at one point Dessalines gave the order, we're told, according to history, kill all whites. That was to go and kill them all. But there is context behind that, and obviously what happened was as well nuanced. It's not very just simple what actually happened there. But if we look at the results of the Haitian Revolution, they abolished slavery before France and Britain. If we look at Algeria, they gained independence for their country. And I do believe that that context, especially that you've just given about the Great Return March and bringing up the history and other examples throughout the Global South, is very important to understanding why a statement like what you've just said makes a lot of sense, and why, for instance, the condemnation of resistance doesn't make sense if you are truly an anti-imperialist and somebody who is an anti-racist as well, because you have to understand these things in their context when it comes to liberation struggles. I know we've taken quite a bit of your time today, and I sincerely thank you for this. And
thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being on, and we'll hope to get you back on.
Now, if you like this video and interview and you want to see more, please support the Palestine Chronicle and make sure to like, subscribe, and share this video.
That was Palestine Chronicle interviewing Professor Mohammed Mirandi of Tehran University in the Islamic Republic of Iran on the current situation in West Asia. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April 20th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. Yeah, we'll be back with our next segment here at the Pan-African Journal.
All right. Okay, we're gone. Roll it. Yeah, bring me champagne when I'm thirsty. Bring me a reaper when I want to get high. Well, you know it shouldn't be no law.
cocaine.
Muddy Waters talking about champagne and reefer here on 420 in recognition of 420 in the United States and worldwide. And we're right now going into a discussion on the history of the settler colonial regime in Israel and its former counterpart in the Republic of South Africa. This is an historical analysis. Let's listen.
Hello,
to this.
And welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We have a special edition today. We're all in the same room for a change. I am Omar Karmi, associate editor, and with me today is Rad Academy and Andrew Feinstein. Rad Academy is a veteran Palestine activist and author of several books, including our most recent One State, the Only Democratic Future for Palestine and Israel, and a memoir in search of Fatima. She was born in Jerusalem, from where she was forced to flee as a young child with her parents and her siblings, including my father, during the Nakba of 1947-49. Andrew Feinstein is from South Africa, where he was an early anti-apartheid activist. He became a member of parliament in the country's first free elections in 1994, for Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. He's son of Holocaust survivors, and he has long been a Palestine activist. Now based in London, he's executive director of Shadow Worlds Investigations. He's author of a book on the ANC after the party, as well as a book on the global arms trade, The Shadow World. Thank you both for being here. Radha, let me start with you. Despite unprecedented global solidarity with Palestine, obviously at the moment, we are in the 6 months of a unfolding genocide in Gaza and facing the very real possibility of the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians yet again from their land. Are we witnessing limits of activism? And what can be done now to stop this?
Look, I mean, the best thing I can say is that it's very difficult to make a judgment on what will happen. It really is. This, in this sense, and in many other senses, the current situation is unprecedented. You know how it was in the past. You used to be able to make some sketchy future scenario based on quite reasonable examination of the facts, of precedent, things like that. We are in a very different world. Since October 7th, among the many things that have happened has been this, the inability to be able to see what the next step is. So, you know, it's very much in my mind when I try to answer your question, because part of me would like to say that no, Israel will not be able to get away with the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. No, Israel cannot continue along this path. Wiser counsels will prevail, this kind of thing. I can't say that. I don't know, is the answer. It is on the cards. I won't put it any more strongly than that. But it is on the cards that Israel may succeed in expelling a large number of Palestinians out of Palestine, as it is succeeding currently in killing so many civilians, something which nobody ever anticipated. So, you know, if you think about it, what with the shooting, bombing and direct hitting of Palestinians, add to it the effects of starvation, of disease, lack of medical facilities. Who knows where this will lead? Now, having said that, what we cannot afford to do is to stop being activists for Palestine. That is not on the cards at all. we have to continue, even with this blind, what I'm calling a blindness to the future, even being lost as to where we are, where it's all going next, we cannot rest for a moment. This is the only possible way forward for ordinary people.
But we have, I mean, I've never seen so many people in so many places take to the streets Palestine. Is there also the flip side of that? Is there also a bit of a South Africa moment here happening?
I think in many ways there are. What has been remarkable is, first of all, as you say, the unprecedented numbers, but on a sustained basis. You know, we've seen huge marches before, of course. Just before the invasion of Iraq, there was a massive march in London and all over the world. But to sustain it as it has been done for 6 months now, where literally every weekend around the world there are huge national marches or myriad local marches. And I think what that reflects is that the political class, supposedly our political leaders, I can't remember since experiencing the late apartheid period when the political class felt so out of touch with the vast majority of citizens and residents of their areas. And, you know, in the United Kingdom, we're seeing a situation where consistently over 70% of people in all polls wanted to see a ceasefire months and months ago, and not one of our major politicians has the courage to actually call for an unqualified ceasefire, permanent ceasefire. Also, I do think that these marches do exert pressure. The fact that the United States of America fairly recently abstained on a ceasefire motion rather than vetoed it, which of course is what it used its veto constantly to defend Israel. And the fact that they've abstained speaks to the reality that Joe Biden is facing significant electoral difficulties, which are in large part down to his completely indefensible position on supporting Israel uncritically and arming Israel. And where the similarity with the sort of late apartheid period in South Africa comes is we saw this sort of growth in momentum of the global anti-apartheid movement and people coming out onto the streets of the BDS movement at the same time as on the ground in South Africa, there was a campaign of ungovernability involving industrial strikes, involving making the apartheid-defined black areas of the country ungovernable. The military and the police could not enter them. And it was the combination of those two factors, but crucially, the impact that BDS and the ungovernability had on the South African economy, and particularly on the quality of life of white South Africans, which deteriorated. And that was the point at which the far right-wing leaders of the apartheid state, and F.W. de Klerk, who won a Nobel Peace Prize with Nelson Mandela, was on the far right of his already fascist party. But he realized the game was up. He was smart enough to know that the game was up because economically apartheid had become unsustainable.
No, no, and you know, I just wanted to say this to you, Andrew. Of course, there are many parallels between the Palestine situation and the situation of apartheid, what was previously apartheid South Africa. But the comparison is not exact.
Oh, absolutely.
And I tell you, in this particular sense, there is an additional factor which makes the struggle of Palestinians extremely difficult, something which the South African struggle did not, in fact, face. And I'll tell you what I mean. The Afrikaners in South Africa were indeed important economically, in terms of outlook, etc., with Western leaders.
Yep.
We know that.
Yep.
But that's as far as it went. Mm. And when there came a time when there was so, the anti-apartheid movement was very strong, as you say, there was civil riots, civil disobedience in South Africa itself, there came a point at which Western leaders thought, is this worth it? Our problem with Israel is we don't have Afrikaners in Israel. What we have is a people, a state composed of people which have, I don't know how to put it, extensions in the Western world. Yep. So what the Palestinians are fighting isn't just some beastly local despot. They are fighting something which has huge reach into the centers of power in the West. And so, which are not just economic, which are not just about, they are much more psychological, almost spiritual, quite extraordinary. The hold that Israel and the idea of Israel has got on Western leaders, and not just Western leaders, many of the populations in the West have now. So in other words, the foe, the nature of the foe in the two examples is different, and is, and the difference is very important. So that's why you're seeing the unbelievable cruelty that Israel is inflicting on the Palestinians, and the lack of response, appropriate response, on the part of any political leader in the West.
Yeah. I think there are two things I'd add to that. The first is, whenever you consider the parallels, there is the very important and quite fundamental domestic economic question, which in the case of South Africa, the apartheid state was entirely dependent on what was effectively indentured black labor to run the economy.
Sure.
So we didn't see, and we would not have seen, massacres and the brutal slaughter of so many in apartheid South Africa that we've seen in Palestine. And it's one of the reasons why Archbishop Desmond Tutu spoke very explicitly about the fact that Israeli apartheid, as he described it, was far more brutal and in many ways far worse than South African apartheid, because there was this economic dependence on a very cheap indentured black labor force. But then when it comes to the Western leadership thing, I would take that one step further. And it is, it's a very complex sort of combination of factors. We shouldn't forget, though, that Western leaders were very complicit with the apartheid South African state, but they were forced to effectively hide and obfuscate that complicity. Whereas Western leaders take enormous pride and believe it's to their political advantage to side uncritically with Israel. And that is a fundamental difference. And of course, unless we understand that difference, it's impossible to think strategically about what all of us, as campaigners, as activists, in some cases Palestinians, can actually do at a global level to ensure, first of all, the cessation of what is happening at the moment, and then, obviously, the broader question of liberation.
I mean, in this context, there's also the whole narrative around anti-Semitism. I mean, you are some, or your mother lost 39 members, I think, of her family in Nazi concentration camps, and the Holocaust informed her political views, and yours too. Not just on apartheid, but on Palestine. I mean, how does this narrative all play into all of this?
It's very interesting, and it's at some levels confused, as personal and family histories and politics always are. So my mother was Austrian, she survived the Holocaust in Vienna itself, and not many Jews did. And the reason she survived is her mother was Jewish and her father was Catholic. He was conscripted into the Reich military after Anschluss in 1938. But fortunately for them, he was a quartermaster. They hid in a cellar, my mom and grandmother, hid in a coal cellar for 3.5 years. And in a sort of a working class district of Vienna where they lived. And when there were raids in the area, my mom would be rolled up in a carpet and the carpet put up against the wall and coal packed around it in case the soldiers managed to shoot their way through the door into the cellar, which fortunately they never managed to do. And they're literally still the bullets. They're not bullet holes because they couldn't penetrate the steel door. And so my mom, after the war, came to London where she met my father, who was South African. And they went back to South Africa together. And my dad, ironically, had been sent to London because he had got involved with a non-Jewish woman in South Africa. And his mother, who was Orthodox, was outraged by this. So she thought she had to send him away. The logic of it wasn't profound, But then when he turned up with my mother, I'm not sure whether my grandmother was more appalled by the fact that, yes, this was a Jewish woman, but she was a working-class Jewish woman, which offended her almost as much. And, you know, very interesting, and my mom spoke about the fact that when she arrived in South Africa, she saw the treatment of black South Africans as not that different to the way European Jews had been treated. And for her, never again, obviously, meant never again for all humanity. You know, at no point would it have entered her mind that never again applied only to Jews. Because, of course, even the victims of the Nazis, of which there were over 12 million, half of whom were not Jewish, but were simply people who the Nazis decided were inferior in various ways. So that was obviously incredibly important to me growing up in a racist apartheid state. And I was very lucky. So my mother would take me to townships illegally from a very young age. She was a puppeteer and she worked at a theater, an illegal theater called the People's Space, which was non-racial, which is why it was illegal. And so, you know, during my school holidays at primary school, I'd have to go in to work with her. But rather than sitting in an office, I was in this theater where, you know, for instance, there was the then young pianist known as Dolla Brand. He became Abdullah Ibrahim, one of South Africa's most famous jazz musicians ever. And he was from a local community, and he obviously didn't have access to a piano, so he would come and practice in the theater. And there was, you know, one of our most extraordinary apartheid-era playwrights by the name of Athol Fugard, and his main collaborators, John Carney and Winston Chawner, who did very, very political plays that were constantly being banned. And these were people, you know, I grew up around them. So I grew up in a very distinct environment that not many white South Africans did. But then, as I became more politically conscientized as I got a bit older, and this is difficult for people to understand, but you know, obviously the struggle against apartheid was at the forefront of our minds politically. But we always saw the Palestinian struggle. From the earliest times that I can remember being politically conscious, we always saw the Palestinian struggle as a fraternal struggle to the apartheid liberation struggle. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. You know, while and we shouldn't ignore the quite fundamental differences, but there are certain important analytical similarities, the settler colonial nature of both situations, I think is very important. The nature of a hyper-militarized racist state and the consequences of that on daily life, very, very similar. And so the ANC, which as soon as I went into townships in my teens, it was clear to me that the ANC and its leadership, who were either imprisoned or in exile, because of course it was a banned illegal organization, had been in alliance with then the PLO for many, many years. So when we were elected after 94, one of the first foreign leaders to address our parliament was Yasser Arafat. And so for me, it's because I'm Jewish, because I'm the son of a Holocaust survivor, because of what my mother took from that appalling experience, that I've worked in the area that I've worked, that I've been an anti-racist my whole life, that I got involved in the anti-apartheid struggle so early. And for me, the real tragedy of it is, you know, I've lectured at Auschwitz, where those members of my mom's family were murdered, on genocide prevention. I've written for the Auschwitz Institute. And to now see that appalling tragedy, that horrific suffering of millions of human beings being used to justify a genocide that we can now see before our eyes, on our screens, in real time. I mean, it's something I never imagined I would experience in my life. And so it feels appalling, indefensible, and incomprehensible at so many levels to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anti-Semitism has effectively been weaponized in this context.
Well, you know, the irony of that is that within the Labour Party under Keir Starmer, I should also mention, besides lecturing at Auschwitz, and I also, when I came to Parliament as a very young MP, I went into the library to find out what had been said about the Holocaust in the South African Parliament. And I discovered that it had never been mentioned in the history of the South African Parliament. Now, when you actually think about it, that's actually not very surprising, because the people who implemented the system of apartheid, who ruled South Africa post the Second World War, were committed Nazis who had been interned in camps, in jail camps, during the war because they were involved in Nazi-supporting militias, etc. Mm-hmm. But I introduced the first ever motion on the Holocaust and its significance in the context of global anti-racism in the entire history of the South African Parliament. Mm-hmm. Then I come to the United Kingdom, and Keir Starmer's Labour Party accuses me of making it difficult for the party to campaign on issues of racism and anti-Semitism. And I think to myself, the world is just completely upside down.
I mean, I was going to say, it's only 10 years ago that a Labour-led motion in Parliament called for the recognition, British recognition of Palestinian state, and signaling, and it was cross-party support, and it signaled at least support for a part of the Palestinian cause. But in 10 years, we are now at a point where pro-Palestine demonstrations are threatened with being criminalized. Chant from river to sea is seen as anti-Semitic, or is portrayed as anti-Semitic.
Unless it's Netanyahu who is using it.
Of course, yes, at the UN, yes.
Yeah.
And we seem to have gone backwards. What's happened in this decade?
Yeah, you know, of course, Andrew, speaking as eloquently as he did about his own origins, his childhood, and the effect of the Holocaust on his life, really draws attention to something which is really important for us Palestinians to never forget, and is not getting away from the answer to your question. It's actually key to the answer. Which is that, you know, listening to you, Andrew, describe your mother's difficulties and being Austrian and all the kind of terrible things that happened to her, made me think, you know, you and I would probably never have met but for what has happened in Palestine and the setting up of the State of Israel. Because what your story illustrates, which is something that I've always thought and that I will never ceases to enrage me, is the way that European history, a slice of European history, of what a bunch of Europeans did to another bunch of Europeans in the 1930s, 40s, somehow became our problem in Palestine. And one must never forget that, because what this has done is that the almost the primacy of narrative has gone to the Jewish story of the Holocaust, of the sufferings of the Jews, of the that has become the primary narrative, and the people who were victimized and whose country was used to as recompense for these sufferings in Europe, my country, Palestine, somehow has got a back seat in all this. Now, it's that utterly unjust imposition on us of, and I repeat, a European history which has nothing to do with the Middle East, nothing to do with the Palestinians, but the way this narrative has been forced on us has consequences, because you can't grow up over on this side of the world with this idea of the primacy of Jewish suffering, for which you must always be either penitent or sensitive or whatever, and the fact that these Palestinians, who are sort of a foreign people, some of them sitting in the Middle East, are all making a fuss, apparently. They want something. They want some recognition. I think it's difficult for people, having been set up like that. There's a setup which says that the Holocaust story, Jewish suffering, Nazism, the terrors of Hitler, all this stuff is at the forefront of people's minds. Only after that, you can start to kind of vaguely try to notice something called Palestinians. It doesn't surprise me that there's been so little movement on recognizing a Palestinian state in a Western parliament, because this is the effect of putting this perfectly valid, by the way, Jewish story of persecution and suffering, putting it to the forefront of people's minds, and everything else is secondary. And most specifically, the victims who were made to pay for crimes they did not commit, and which is deeply embarrassing. So the less you hear about them, the better, you know? So it's a very convoluted answer to your question, but I think it's extremely important.
But that did seem to be, you know, very, very slow, very incremental progress, and Palestinians were more and more successful with telling their stories, and it gained some mainstream recognition, at least. And it seemed to me that 2014 marked, at least in the UK, a sort of a peak. But then it went down so rapidly over the last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, let me comment about that. Of course, by the way, in having said what I said, does not mean that Palestinians were kind of passive suffering creatures that never did a thing. No. In fact, Andrew reminded us of this really striking fact about Yasser Arafat, that slice of history in which he came to South Africa. He was close to Nelson Mandela. Arafat, whatever else people might have talked about, might say about him, was extremely wise about the associations he made. The fact that he put Palestine into the forefront of the non-aligned movement is very important. So it's all of that, and the Palestine Liberation Organization, which he led and which Palestinians set up without anybody's help. It's all those things that, of course, changed the atmosphere and made some people in the West sympathetic and want to actually help, and hence led to some of these achievements. You know, but in fact, those Palestinian actions were provoked into being, where it would never have been natural for a very agrarian population. We must never forget that. Mm-hmm. Palestinians were an agrarian population of farmers and peasants. That's really what they were. Catapulted into, you know, the complexities of the 20th century, having to pick themselves up off the soil and get going. It's really, it's absolutely remarkable.
It really is. Just coming back to the first point you made, which I think is such a crucial one. And, you know, I feel this coming from one of Britain's colonies, how it often feels as though you are a sort of a plaything of the global north, that you're not taken seriously in your own right. You are seen through the perspective of the Europeans who turned up in our country, in South Africa. And, of course, claiming in 1652 when they did, that there was no one there. But then they fought all these wars. And I always found this, you know, under apartheid in South Africa, we would learn a very narrow and jaundiced perspective of history. And it was, of course, the apartheid history. And we were told both these things. They turned up and there was no one there. And then there were all these heroic wars that they fought and won. And I remember saying to my history teacher, if there was no one there, who were they fighting the wars against?
Mm.
And why was it necessary to fight the wars?
Mm.
I never received a substantive answer. You wouldn't be surprised. But, you know, and it reminds me when you hear some Zionists talk about what is today the state of Israel as a land with no people for a people with no land. And you think to yourself, how can people, having come out of what they have, instantaneously lose any sense of context, history, or reality?
Yeah.
And I think this is another part of the tragedy. It's not just, and I take your point entirely, that it's European suffering that has been imposed on a people who had absolutely nothing to do with it, probably weren't even aware of it to a large extent because of the way in which you describe the people of Palestine in that period. And you would think that a people who have suffered to the extent the European Jewry did, that foremost in their mind would be the view of some survivors, a tiny minority, who say, because of our suffering, it is our responsibility to call out similar suffering of other people wherever we see it. But in fact, we've done exactly the opposite. And I was just going to finish that by saying that, you know, it comes back to, why was it South Africa that made a submission to the International Court of Justice? It's because of that long history of the relationship between the Palestinian struggle and the apartheid South African struggle, first of all. Mm-hmm. But second of all, it's also because we feel a responsibility to speak out when we see a people suffering in the way that we ourselves as South Africans suffered. And of course, I have to say this with a caveat that I, because of the color of my skin, experienced South Africa from a position of privilege. So I sometimes feel somewhat awkward talking in this way, but I'm talking about the perspective of the majority of South Africans, that we feel that where we see similar suffering that is as incomprehensible to us, but has similar roots in the arrogance and brutality of European settler colonialism, we feel a responsibility to speak out. And it was brilliantly put by Mandela quite soon after he was released. Before he was president of the country, he made a trip to the US. And of course he was asked by various news people who said things to him like, why do you have a relationship with the PLO? Why do you have a relationship with Cuba? And he said, you need to understand, your enemies are not our enemies.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly important to understand.
Yeah.
That the reason of these close ties between South Africa and Palestine is also because of the nature of what we've suffered and how we've suffered.
But also, of course, South Africa didn't look at Palestine through European lenses, as Mandela put it there. I mean, I knew people who had fought in, you know, pre-state Zionist militias and would tell me, you know, you've got to understand, we didn't think of them as Palestinians, we just thought of them as Arabs, which strikes me as exactly that European lens, as in, I mean, A, so what, but B, it's just this sort of idea that there's an indistinguishable mass of people here.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's what you're seeing now. This is what October the 7th also unmasked, exactly this attitude that these are non-people, in a sense, and therefore things that are being done to them don't feel the same as things being done to real people.
But let's be absolutely clear and explicit about that. This is exactly the same racist white supremacy that is informing the Western reaction to the genocide in Palestine today, that informed the apartheid South African project. These are non-people. Because that's the only way you can do the things that the apartheid state did, that the Israeli state is doing. It is the only way, because if you looked at it from the perspective of a functioning human being, there is absolutely no way to defend this. And so we defend it through the dehumanization.
Yeah.
But that what that in turn does, and I know this shouldn't be our major concern, but to come back to the question that you asked initially, that dehumanization of the other does something else in the process. It totally dehumanizes the oppressor as well. And I saw it in South Africa where people thought they were decent, civilized people. Of course, now you can't find a white person who ever supported apartheid in South Africa. And who the millions were who kept on voting the National Party back into power, we will never know. They must have all been holograms. But the reality is those people, the vast majority of ordinary people, became monsters. And the reason I make that point is because the vast majority of our political leaders, of our establishment or commercial media, those people, the ruling elites who are justifying what is happening in Palestine, have turned into monsters.
I mean, it brings me back to the question I did want to ask before about the 10 years from 2014 till now, particularly in the Labour Party. I mean, there's been this enormous sea change in the Labour Party, and obviously a lot of it has to do with the anti-Semitism issue. which was made an issue in within the Labour Party during the Corbyn years. But it's been a remarkable reversal of policy.
But you say that, but you know, please don't forget that the Labour Party historically supported the Zionists. So in fact, the fact that there were more progressive people on the left who were also members of the Labour Party made that, ameliorated that. It doesn't change the basic fact that Labour historically almost identified with the Zionists in the belief, very mistaken of course, in the belief that these were fellow socialists, as you might say. And so that was, by the way, so it doesn't particularly surprise me that...
But that is still going back a bit. I mean, you know, the image of Israel as somehow being a plucky little, communal state with socialist ethos.
Yes.
It went a long
time ago. Yes, but you see, you know, we need, of course, to always remember that the Zionist propaganda machine is extremely active. It's very powerful and it's very effective, and it never sleeps. So your question about anti-Semitism, and then the idea, as you just said just now, that the image of Israel, which is very carefully cultivated as a poor little fledgling state trying to find its way, and all these monstrous Arabs are threatening it, it's all fabricated by the Zionists. So the latest in, and it's fascinating, we don't have the time on this program to talk about the unfolding, the evolution of propaganda on behalf of the Zionists, which they created and which they know how to disseminate, which is really very interesting. But its latest manifestation is, of course, anti-Semitism. This is fabricated by them. It's created by them in order to, of course, we know, to delegitimize anybody who criticizes the state of Israel. And that's what you're seeing. So in a way, it's important never to lose sight of that. I know that sometimes one is tempted to forget about it and sort of scratch one's head and think, my God, you know, how much, what else does Israel have to do to start being criticized? Don't forget the power of this counterforce, which is brought to bear the moment there's any swing towards the other side, towards the Palestinians. And you can see it now, very powerfully in action, everywhere.
I think there are a couple of other things that I would add to that. You know, first of all, on the Labour Party, I mean, the Labour Party's history on foreign policy generally has been dismal, generally, throughout its history. And there have been moments of exceptionalism, but the overall arc of Labour Party history on British foreign policy hasn't been that great, first of all. Second of all, we must remember what Margaret Thatcher, towards the end of her life, described as her greatest achievement, Tony Blair. And what she meant by that was she turned the Labour Party into a neoliberal, warmongering party.
Sure.
So that the establishment in the United Kingdom was completely comfortable if the Labour Party won power. Because to continue this chimera of democracy, we have to have occasional changes of the ruling party. And we're seeing that again now, where the establishment feels quite comfortable with Keir Starmer because he is a creation of the establishment, and they know he will threaten nothing. And it's why Jeremy Corbyn could not become Prime Minister of Britain. His attitude, his internationalist attitude generally, but specifically his attitude towards Israel and towards the role of Britain in the world and Britain's arms trade, which is a source of massive corruption and huge human suffering all over the world.
Mm.
That was simply untenable to the establishment, which is why the 2017 election, where he came close to being elected, was such a shock. And they tried everything against him. You know, Russian spy, Czech spy, this, that, and the other. And eventually, the one that worked was anti-Semitism, because an enormous number of people in polite British society find it very difficult to stand up against claims of anti-Semitism.
Right.
Even when those claims are weaponized, like we've seen them weaponized, as part of what is, or what would have been in a more sane political moment in our history, a tool of a movement of the far right wing.
Yeah.
You know, today they're probably the right wing, but in my time they would have been the far right wing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is we mustn't be ashamed to call that out. You know, when people call me an anti-Semite, I explain to them what anti-Semitism actually is, rather than the way in which they're using it. And then they start saying, well, you're a self-hating Jew, you're not a real Jew, you're a cuppo, which your mother must have been if she survived the war. You know, this sort of absolute and disgusting nonsense. And I always wonder to myself, who appointed these people as the new deities, that they can now reinterpret the scriptures and decide who is and isn't a proper Jew? I mean, this is the extent of the madness that we're experiencing. But I think it also falls within a sort of a global move over the past dozen or so years towards a sort of an extreme ethno-nationalism, where racism in so many forms has reared its head again. And, you know, again, the irony of this and the absurdity of this is that when we see Israel's allies, besides the obvious America, the UK, most Western European countries, you know, in political leaders like Viktor Orban or Mahendra Modi or Donald Trump. You know, these are all people who personally have quite anti-Semitic instincts by all accounts. And if they don't, they're certainly happy to use anti-Semitism for their own political purposes. I mean, Orban, for instance, the Hungarian Prime Minister, uses this appalling anti-Semitic imagery in every election campaign that he runs to hold on to power. But he is welcome to Israel constantly and regularly as a great friend of the Israeli state. So we have the state of Israel actually aligning itself with real, live anti-Semites,
yeah,
but then accusing other people of being anti-Semitic in order to protect itself. This is the sort of madness that we inhabit at the moment. And I think the most important thing we can do to find a way out of this is to keep on making these things explicit, to keep on speaking out, writing about how these things are being abused and who suffers the consequence of them. Because, of course, the primary sufferers, if you will, are the Palestinian people. But even in the United Kingdom today, if we see this extraordinary rise of Islamophobia, which is barely mentioned in our mainstream media, it's all about the rise in anti-Semitism. And of course, a rise in any form of racism is appalling. But you can't speak about the one without the other. And for me, what is so terrifying in the United Kingdom is that Islamophobia is primarily generated by and emanates from the state itself.
Like we saw recently.
Exactly. And that is really scary.
Yeah.
And so that closes down the space to be able to criticize the state of Israel, to be able to criticize the ongoing genocide. And our responsibility is to try and open that space by speaking out as loudly and as constantly as we can.
I mean, we were supposed to be over all this. I mean, frankly, the anti-apartheid movement was supposed to, you know, put the final nail in the coffin of worldwide racism.
Sure.
And yet we're back to it, the immigration debate, the Islamophobia.
Sure. You know, which actually leads me to ask Andrew a question. Very mindful of us conversing, which I value, I really do. If we look at our comparable struggles, in your case against South African type apartheid, which fortunately for you resulted in victory, and we, in our struggle as Palestinians against Israeli-type apartheid, which we have not yet overcome, how can we as Palestinians learn things from you? Is there something where we haven't done or should be doing, or where did we, how could we improve our performance? Because I tell you, it's become absolutely urgent. This is not not an academic question.
No, absolutely.
We need definitely to have a strategy, an intelligent strategy, to fight what I was described just recently as overwhelming odds.
Yeah.
Really.
And can I supplement that with the question of what is the role of charismatic leadership in that?
Mm.
Because you had Nelson Mandela. I mean, you mentioned Yasser Arafat, who for all his, you know, issues was a very charismatic leader.
Unfortunately, in the world in which we live, and I think if anything it's got worse since, you know, the days of Yasser Arafat and even Nelson Mandela, who didn't pass that long ago, but it feels like a lifetime in some senses in terms of what's happened politically. I think, sadly, that sort of charismatic leadership is important. I think it's so much more difficult to emerge in the Palestinian context because potential leaders are snuffed out so much more quickly. So, you know, an interviewer asked me, a fairly mainstream television channel recently, and said to me, well, you know, you had Mandela, who do the Palestinians have? And I said, well, you know, there are all sorts of people I could name, but the vast majority of them are sitting in Israeli jails and have been for as long, if not longer, than Mandela sat in an apartheid jail. So I think there probably are Palestinian leaders, but I think that because of the license that Israel has to repress in a way that the apartheid South African state never did, or to the extent that the apartheid South African state never did, it makes the emergence of that leadership so much more difficult.
Right.
But at the same time as saying that, not discounting the importance of charismatic leadership, a struggle has to gain traction amongst tens of millions of people globally. And I think what the ANC was very successful at, which has caused us problems since our democracy has been in place, to be honest, is we were an incredibly broad church as a liberation movement.
Mm.
And we were incredibly inclusive. Yes, of course, there were splits. There was the Pan-Africanist Congress. There was the Azanian People's Organization, the Black Consciousness Movement.
Mm.
But we were all broadly aligned with our tactics of struggle. And I think internationally, the most important of those was obviously the BDS movement against South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel that in the case of Palestine, because of all the obstacles we've spoken about
yeah.
in terms of our own governments, media, etc., in the so-called West, that hasn't gained the traction that it did in the case of the South African apartheid struggle. And, you know, one of the few tiny slivers of light amidst this horrendous unfolding tragedy in Gaza and on the West Bank, we shouldn't forget, is that I think an enormous number of ordinary people around the world, in the global South, it's very apparent, but even in the so-called Western world, in the global North, a lot of very ordinary people are starting to see Israel in a very different light.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes this moment an incredibly important mm-hmm. one. And I honestly believe that the struggle for the liberation of Palestine needs to coalesce around the BDS struggle and around encouraging as many people as possible across the world to respond to this genocide by doing things they can do in their own lives. You know, just like when you walk into a supermarket, like people used to walk past the Outspan oranges, which were in South Africa.
That's right, yes.
They used to drive past the Shell petrol station and onto the next one. Not that the next oil company was any better, but at least they weren't the primary provider of oil to the apartheid military in South Africa. I really think, you know, not that it's my place to give this advice, but that would be my overwhelming focus, and also the amount of work that was done by people like Oliver Tambo, Joe Slovo, Thabo Mbeki, Ruth First before she was murdered by the apartheid state, and many, many others, in getting the media on side, which is, of course, much more difficult now because you just don't have the access to the sort of commercialized media that wasn't as commercial in those days, where, you know, the BBC, they would give them a platform.
Yeah.
Even while the British government was trying to stop any support for boycott of South African goods, et cetera, et cetera. So it is incredibly difficult, but I do think that that needs to be the focus, and that in a time of the struggle for liberation, the things that unite us, and I know it sounds trite, but the things that unite us being so much more important than the things on which we have differences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, it is not my place to lecture to Palestinian people on any issue. But from my own experience of struggle, that was where the ANC had success. You know, we had within the movement, economically, we had everybody from Thatcherites to the far, far left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
And for the sake of our struggle for liberation, they all worked together, despite those differences.
Mm-hmm.
And I find even, you know, in the United Kingdom, there are some differences between groups who are working towards the liberation of Palestine that are based here And I just constantly think to myself, because I sort of tend to work across the board, and I often just want to say to people, these differences, be they strategic, be they ideological, be they personal, are so much less important than getting ourselves out of the situation where it is possible to commit a genocide against the Palestinian people, and our governments do absolutely nothing about it except provide the weapons for it and therefore profit from it. So I think that would be the overwhelming message.
Yeah.
Those differences.
Well, thank you. I mean, I take away two things from that. First of all, the importance of leadership.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, even if it's not charismatic,
Even
if it were not charismatic, you need a leadership. Any kind of struggle needs a clear leadership. And when you think about the outpouring of sympathy of so many ordinary people over on this side of the world who long to aim, they want to support what the Palestinians want. And then the question is, what do the Palestinians want? So you immediately are up against this really serious and very debilitating fact, which is that there is no unified leadership and no unified vision beyond, of course, right-sounding and very vague ideas of liberation and freedom and so on. So that's one. And the other takeaway is the fact that the media is crucial because the narrative has been so crucial. In the case of Palestine-Israel, you know, the real battle was for the story, the narrative. Because if you think about it, when this insane idea that you actually have a bunch of Europeans go out to a country full of other people and really seriously think about establishing a state for themselves in this place, it's insane.
Yeah.
How do you make it pass? You have to get a convincing story. And they did. They did brilliantly. The Bible, the Old Testament, people coming home, persecution, we need a refuge, all this together worked very well indeed. And they've been controlling the narrative ever since. Where the media comes in, let me just say, where the media comes in, of course, is in the propagation of this narrative. So it follows that if we as Palestinians were able to make inroads into media representation of another story, which is quite different, a story not just about us as a poor little people, etc., but to do with justice, to do with freedom, to do with oppression, to do etc., it would help in a big way.
You're absolutely right, and the ANC and the broader liberation movement was superb at telling the story of apartheid in South Africa. But there are the added difficulties. You very early on in our conversation, you spoke about the difference between the Afrikaners
and the Zionists.
And the Zionists. Mm. And because of this very complex psychological, political, anthropological manifestation that has resulted in the West swallowing the story whole and being incredibly uncritical towards it. I mean, the South African state tried to buy up newspapers. Fully half of the apartheid budget was off the books. Not even Parliament got to see it. And it was used for all sorts of clandestine activity, including up buying media in the United States of America here, etc., etc. It didn't work. And it didn't work because the liberation movement, across its various parts, did have a clear narrative and made absolutely clear what the story was. And it was a very simple narrative. This is one of the greatest injustices that has ever been perpetrated against humanity. It is racist in nature, and it has to come to an end. For the world to be a civilized place, this has to come to an end. It was pretty much as simple as that. And that is not different to the narrative about Palestine.
No.
But it had a very clear end.
in a secular, democratic, single state.
That's the other thing. There was a lot of debate, and we forget this. You know, in the moment, we look at our struggles, the apartheid struggle. Oh, my goodness, what an effective struggle. Believe me, being a part of that struggle from the inside didn't seem particularly focused, clear, or effective at all. It is retrospectively that it feels far more like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to bear in mind. In 1986, when I had to leave South Africa, if someone had told me that apartheid would be over 4 years later, I would have used my training as a clinical psychologist and offered them a straitjacket, because there was absolutely no prospect of it. You know, we were in what we called the reform repression cycle, which was absolutely brutal on the ground. And the state seemed so powerful, and it had so much support from Western Europe, the UK, and the United States of America, that we just couldn't see how it went 4 years later. So you do need a confluence of geopolitical factors, of economic factors, and others. But I do think...
And that was an extended discussion, a comparative analysis between settler colonialism in Southern Africa and what exists today in West Asia vis-a-vis Palestine. And that's going to conclude the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for today. You've been listening to this program for Saturday, April the 20th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And if you'd like to have access to this program, all you need to do is go to our website, and that is at blogtalkradio.com/ Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/ Pan-African Journal. And if you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website, panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Red Garland from the album entitled Groovy. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.